You ready for some coffee, honey?
Absolutely.
I'll pour.
Great coffee. I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli.
And I'm Linda Martinelli.
And we are talking
while married. Well, it's Ron and Linda still on the road. This is a long road trip. You know, I want to kind of start with Memorial Day, Ron, with the meaning and just the thankfulness that we have for our military members that have given the ultimate sacrifice for all of us.
And I think people need to remember that there is a difference between Memorial Day and Veterans Day.
Yes.
So Veterans Day is where we celebrate the service of all of our men and women in all of our wars, both in theaters of war and outside of theaters of war, where Memorial Day is where we memorialize those men and women, soldiers, sailors, Marine, Coast Guards, Air Force, who have died in all of our theaters of war.
Yes.
And by the way, since 1775 to this date, so we're going all the way from the Revolutionary War to the Global War on Terror, which we are still experiencing, the United States of America has lost 959,000 of our troops.
Wow, that's a staggering number. And when I think about that, I think about all those young men. I mean, we have...
And women.
And women. We, you know, as parents of four children, I just can't even imagine the loss of one of those children in, you know, in any circumstance, but 900 and some thousand are lives that really, you know, would have made a difference in the world, that would have had children, that would have had families, that would have, gone on to who knows what in their lives. And it's just such a tragic shame. And we owe them such a debt of gratitude for giving that ultimate sacrifice so that we can have the freedoms that we enjoy in the United States of America.
And, you know, that's really important because it just underscores the phrase that freedom isn't free, and that people every single day going from the Revolutionary War to even today are paying the ultimate sacrifice so that we can live our lives in freedom. And that's so important because what you and I are seeing, because we've talked about this so many times together, is that we are losing our sense of history with respect to our different wars and the sacrifices that our men and women in uniform have made.
Yes, we are losing our history, and that is just directly the fault of our schools and our school unions and the people who make the decisions about the curriculum. And they are taking these histories, like the Civil War, where, by the way, Ron, there's different figures on how many young people died in that Civil War, but somewhere between 480,000 and 620,000 people died in the Civil War.
And you know, and I've got those statistics and I just want to share them in a little bit, but you're absolutely right. You know, since you brought up the Civil War, and I don't think the majority of young people today could even tell you when the Civil War occurred, because you mentioned it. And, you know, we have a friend that works for a school district down in Southern California, and she's in the administration, and she was just sharing with us just last week that they are getting new U.S. history textbooks, and they've completely removed the section on the Civil War and replaced it with some other, you know, specious discussion that has nothing to do with U.S. history. And that's, by the way, and when was the Civil War? The Civil War was from 1861 to 1865, and our losses, as you stated, but I'm going to break it down, the Union lost 364,000 men, because they did not have women, fighting on either side,
yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And the Confederacy lost 123,000 people. So there's your, you know, your figures of approximately somewhere between 480 and, you know, 600,000 people. By the way, that doesn't include how many people on both sides, the tens of thousands, were wounded and subsequently succumbed from their wounds. So, you know, that's a lot of people. Well, Lynn, would you like to hear some statistics that I've drawn up from the Veterans Administration website on the different wars and losses and deployments?
Oh, sure.
Well, let's just start out with the Revolutionary War. There were 217,000 people deployed in the Continental Army. That's what it was called in those days. And we lost about 4,400 people. So our freedom from tyranny and the British cost us 4,400 American lives. And then I'm going to skip down to the Civil War, and we had a couple of million people on both sides deployed there, and we already gave the battle statistics for that.
Well, and by the way, that is where Memorial Day started, was in the time of the Civil War, to honor those that lost their lives there in that Civil War.
Right. And we've had some other skirmishes and small wars. So, you know, we had the War of 1812. I don't have the statistics for that. And that was another war against the British. And then we also had the Spanish-American War, which I think we lost about 1,200 people. And that was just at the before the turn of the century. I think it was around 1898, and that lasted about 2 years. And then we went to World War One, and in World War One, we lost 110,000 Americans that died in combat and also in theater from other causes. So they were deployed, and of course, that war went from 1914 to just about 1918. So that was about a 4-year war. And we entered that war, if you remember.
I wasn't around then, Ron.
Well, if you remember your history, Linda, we entered that war a little bit later. But the big war, and what we refer to as the greatest generation, is World War II. And we had about 291,557 of our American soldiers and all of our American military personnel that were deployed were killed in action. But we also had another 113,842 other non-theater but World War II related battle deaths. And we had 670,846 non-mortally wounded. But here's what's interesting about World War II, because we lose about 350 of our World War II veterans every single day. Now, by the way, we have no living World War I veterans. So we are coming up this June, we are coming up to the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and that is our invasion of the Normandy coast in France to retake Europe, and it actually is described as the beginning of the end of Hitler's regime and tyranny and the beginning of the end of World War II. And so if an American teenager who was 18 years old was enlisted or drafted into the military on D-Day in June of 1944, they would be 93 years old at that anniversary date. 93 years old. So you can imagine, you know, how old, you know, and why we're losing all of these veterans. And I think, and by the way, if they came in when they were in 1941 at 18 years old, they'd be 97 years old.
Right.
So you can see exponentially how that's going to increase. Well, and we're going to lose more and more World War II veterans.
And we are losing them at a rapid pace. And you know, the thing is that because they've taken these wars and the reasons for them, which is really important, out of a lot of our history books, and they're not teaching it like they used to. The message that we should have learned from having these wars is lost on our youth, and that's a really tragic thing. And we've talked about it a lot of times, where other countries honor their history and they teach it over and over and over. They ingrain it in the minds of their youth so that these things don't happen again. And we're going in the opposite direction in this country, which I really don't understand. And we are losing a generation of people that were in World War II that have
the knowledge.
The knowledge, and it needs to be put down into books, and it has been put down. But our schools have chosen to eliminate it from their curriculum or gloss over it and not have it be as important as it is to the history of our country.
And, you know, we've been to Europe so many times that we're going to Europe again this year, and we were just there last year, and you're absolutely right. They memorialize their history in World War I and especially in World War II, which is quite meaningful to them. They do not tear down statues like we do in the United States. They do not erase history, both physical history that is there and also a documented history, which is in their school books. As a matter of fact, they want their children, their students, to remember how Europe got into World War II, and especially with fascism and with Nazism. And that's one of the problems that I know you and I have here in the United States, where we get these young people throwing these terms out like fascism and Antifa, which is supposed to be anti-fascism, and they act exactly like the fascists did in Italy under Benito Mussolini, which is my home country, and they act exactly like Adolf Hitler and Dr. Joseph Goebbels, and who was the propaganda minister in World War II and leading up to the Nazi takeover, political takeover in the late 20s, early 30s, you know, obviously in the 40s before we had to go in and take care of that problem. So by not memorializing this in the United States, our people forget about history. Can I point something out? This, and I don't want to monopolize the conversation, but I wanted to point out that as the people are talking, the pundits are talking about all of our losses on Memorial Day, they conveniently forgot about the Korean War. And so, and it's interesting because that's why the Korean War historically is referred to as the Forgotten War. So just to remind everybody, the Korean War was from 1950 to 1953, taking place obviously on the Korean Peninsula. And we had about 1,789,000 of our troops were deployed, you know, during that three-year period, off and on for that three-year period in Korea, and we lost 38,000 people killed in action. You know, in Vietnam, which is the war that most people remember today, we had 3.4 million people deployed over a period, a lengthy period, from 1964 to 1975, and there was a combined death total both in theater and out of theater, but directly related to injuries and their Vietnam deployment of 38,000 people. I'm sorry, of 58,000 people.
And of those 58,000 people, Ron, 33,000 were 18 years old. Think about that. These are babies. They're 18 years old. They're just starting their life. And they're getting, you know, trained, and they're getting guns, and they go over there and I mean, just in horrific conditions. This was in our time, the Vietnam War. And, you know, I actually lost my boyfriend at the time in the Vietnam War. If people have not had the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. and see the Korean Memorial, the Korean War Memorial, and the Vietnam Memorial, it will break your heart. And it will really put into perspective the lives that we've lost in this country and the toll that it takes on our country. And it's not something that I'm saying we shouldn't get into wars. From the beginning of time, man has gotten into wars. Just there's never not been wars in the world, but just the toll that it takes, and you would think that we would have learned our lesson, and we don't. And it's even worse now, you know, when we have the youth today tearing down the statues from the Civil War because they don't understand who those people were and what they really did. They think they do, and they think that they, you know, because they were on one side or the other, they were a bad person, they're going to tear it down, but they don't understand the context of those wars and why they happened, and that a lot of those people on both sides were good people.
And they don't understand, and me speaking as a, you know, a former United States history teacher before I became police officer, they don't even know what the causes of the Civil War
exactly
were. They think that the Civil War was all about slavery, and that was only one of a number of actually even more components or causes of why we had the Civil War in the first place. I'm not diminishing slavery, because it certainly was an important component, but that's, slavery wasn't why the North and the South, you know, the South seceded from the United States and we had the Civil War,
yes,
in the first place. And that's just a tragedy that kids today don't even, and young adults don't even know that.
And they don't, they also don't know that it was Republicans who stopped slavery, not Democrats.
Sure.
But, you know, the thing is, the tragedy to me is when you take the Civil War out of history books and instead you replace it with LGBTQ, I'm speechless at it, really,
which is what happened in that school district,
yes,
that I was talking about.
Well, it's happening in a lot of school districts, and that is not history. We don't need to talk about sexuality to our children. That's not the place of the school district. But teaching our children the history of this country that they live in is their job, and they're abdicating their job. I just want to say one more thing, Ron, about people who losing their lives in wars. It's not just people losing their lives in the war theater. We currently have, between 2008 and 2016, we have lost 6,000 veterans a year to suicide. And that's a direct result of their experiences being in the military, for whether it's PTSD or whether they could never get their life back together. And that's just as much of a tragedy also. So there's a lot of things that President Trump has done. One of the things has been helping the VA, because of those people that committed suicide, and there's a large number there, most all of them had not been to a VA doctor in the previous 2 years before their suicide. He's opened that up now so that they can see any doctor and get help. And there's several organizations, Independence Fund being one of them, independencefund.org, that really truly helps veterans. And what I will say that really impresses me is the White House Veterans Office has now resolved 93% of veteran issues brought to them. And this is unprecedented in the history with the previous presidents. So President Trump is making a real effort to help our veterans so that we stop the continuing loss of our military members.
And, you know, because we are talking about those members and the increase in suicidality and PTSD as a result of in even our most recent wars and conflicts. So let's not forget are veterans that fell in the field during Desert Shield and Desert Storm, which was a very quick war. If you remember that, it was almost a, you know, like a 24-hour war, but it actually lasted for a year. So we had Desert Storm at first, and then once we got in and started doing the mop-up, we had Desert Shield. But because we fight wars so much differently now, people were anticipating huge losses against the Iraqis and, you know, their Republican Guard and everything. But actually, and we had 664,000 people deployed, but we lost less than 400 people during that entire 1 year period.
What a difference.
Oh, huge difference,
yeah,
in the way that we fight wars today. And then I don't have any stats on our global war on terror, but people need to remember that that began in 2001 and it still continues today.
Yes. God bless the people who gave their lives to give us our freedoms.
And remember, when you are, you know, driving by a car and you see a sticker that has a gold star on it, or you see a gold star on the window or a gold star flag in front of a house, the gold star indicates that that is a family that has lost a loved one in our conflicts. God bless them all.
Well, the Out Loud perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutLoud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
I want to talk about a subject that you know quite a bit about and part that I know about. So the part you know about is murder. And the part that I know about is fake news. And you put those two together and you get a story about where murders are actually happening in our country.
And you know, this is an interesting article that we read, and I got to give the guy credit. It's L.A. Paredes, and the website is California GunOwnersOfCalifornia.com. I think it is, CaliforniaGunOwners.com. And what is so interesting in this article, and I had to do some vetting as a, you know, doing what I do for a living, I had to vet the article to see, in fact, if it was correct. And only 2% of American counties nationwide account for 51% of all homicides nationwide. Absolutely incredible. But there's a follow-up statistic to that. And 54% of counties in the United States have no homicides whatsoever.
You wouldn't think any of this listening to the media, though, Ron. And that's what's really fascinating. I mean, I have to say it again. 2% of the counties account for 51% of homicides.
Yeah, and if people go over to the Gun Owners California.com website, they're going to see that Mr. Paredes was kind enough to give us a map of the United States with all of the different states and a lot of the counties highlighted. And when you take a look at it, it is immediately notable that Southern California is completely red. So it looks like Southern California is one of the murder capitals of the United States. And so I took a look at that, and I extrapolated and went out to some of the more famous areas of the United States where I'm involved in a lot of homicide investigations. And so I looked at Detroit, I looked at Baltimore, I looked at New York, and I looked at Chicago. And they are, those counties are all, the counties, the major urban counties, are completely red. And what I found so interesting is that just like in Southern California, that has the most restrictive gun laws pretty much in the United States. And when you look at these other places like Chicago, like Detroit, like Baltimore, like Washington, D.C., you will see not only do they have the most restrictive gun laws in the United States like Southern California, but they're all democratically controlled.
Well, and that's a really interesting comparison to make, because what's happening, what's really not happening, is controlling guns is not helping the murder in those places. And in fact, they have the worst statistical murder rates of anywhere in the country. Now, you take that the country in the middle of the country, where there are a lot of places that have open carry, where there are a lot of places that, you know, you can get CCWs or LTCs or whatever they happen to call them in that state, license to carry, the murder rates are either nothing or very, very small. And when you look at the map of, say, Texas, who has open carry, it's very spotty. There are no big areas of a lot of red on the map. There are just little spotty areas in urban cities, but nothing like you see in the other states.
No, and you're exactly right. So, you know, you brought up LTC, License to Carry, which is the state of Texas, and then I brought up the city of Baltimore. So let's just do a little compare and contrast, because what you're referring to is great, because they're flyover states. And California, of course, Texas is a flyover state. So let's just take a look at Baltimore and compare it to Houston, where I just worked a homicide investigation just last week. So Baltimore has a population of 615,000 people, Baltimore, Maryland, as opposed to Houston that has a 2.2 million population. But take a look at Baltimore, which is the number one homicide city in the United States and democratically controlled. In 2018, they had 342 homicides, and they were shooting homicides. 50% of the shooting homicides, the victim was shot in the head by the suspect. So that tells me, you know, as a homicide investigator, that tells me something very important, because a lot of shootings, you know, take place sporadically and, you know, in rapidly evolving situations. But when you're just directly shot in the head, those are more like assassinations, and that's more like gang-related
crime.
But here's what I thought was interesting. In Baltimore, the per capita homicide rate, as far as 2018, obviously we don't have the 2019 stats, is 51.4, almost 51.5 per 100,000 population. So just think of that. In 100,000 people, 51.5 people are going to get killed per year by homicide, and the vast majority from shooting. Houston, which has over 2 million people, their homicide rate per 100,000 is half of that. It's less than half of that. It's only 22 per 100,000 people.
And it used to be a lot less.
And Houston does not have, because it's in Texas, it does not have the restrictive gun laws that Baltimore has. As a matter of fact, it's pretty easy to get an LTC or a license to carry in the state of Texas. And when you have a lot of people running around with guns, you don't get the confrontations that you have when only the criminals have guns, because you have such restrictive gun laws that only the bad guys have guns, and the good people are actually prevented legally from owning or carrying guns in public.
Well, I want to digress for a second, Ron, because I watched a video that was taken inside somebody's home who had cameras inside their home, and it was a young lady who was asleep in her home, and three thugs broke in very quietly, and you could see them on the camera, and they went into some rooms, and they took her purse, and they took other things, and then they went and got some cord and things to tie her up. So they were headed towards her bedroom, by which time she had awoke and pulled a gun and walked out and took a shot at them. And they ran off and jumped out the window.
So don't take a cord to a gunfight, right?
They did have a gun.
Okay.
But they still jumped out the window. And this is what we always talk about, that if you are not able to defend, that woman would have been probably raped, tied up, beaten, who knows what, had she not had that gun in her home to defend herself.
Well, you know, that's exactly right. And I think there's a viral video that you and I just saw just yesterday. And it was the store clerk, and the guy comes in
with a hatchet
to rob the store clerk. And the store clerk pulls out a gun, and the guy puts the hatchet down on the counter, gets down on his knees, puts his hands over his head, and surrenders to the guy with the gun. Guess what happened with the guy with the gun?
Well,
you remember?
I know what happened. Well,
He
got fired because the owners of the establishment say that they have a
zero
tolerance for firearms in their stores. But this guy saved that store.
And saved his life and the other patrons.
And Exactly. And save the store from being robbed.
And thanks a lot, you lost your job.
Yeah.
Right? So let me talk about another city, one of my favorite cities, and I also do work there, and that's Chicago. So, and they've had an astronomical homicide rate, but last year their homicide rate actually was reduced by 18%, and that's a pretty darn good reduction. They're trying to make some changes in policing in the state of Chicago. But so in 2017, they had 2,217 homicide. That was an all-time high for the city of Chicago. So last year, their homicide rate dropped, like I said, 18% with 1,843. Now, so far, just in the month of May, 41 people have been killed. As a matter of fact, 206 people were shot, 38 were killed from gunfire. And what's really interesting in the city of Chicago, there's a website called Jackass.
Heyjackass.com.
That's a great one. I want heyjackass.com. And
it sounds like a joke, but it's not a joke.
And they do fantastic vetted statistical work. And, you know, I've used that site before in my Black Lives Matter book. And here's what was very interesting. The thing that I love about heyjackass.com is they've got something called the shot clock. And so it will tell you on a daily basis when people are shot. And what I found out in looking at it just this morning, because I knew we were going to have this coffee conversation, is that a person in Chicago is shot every 4 minutes. So, Lynn, according to the shot clock on jackass.com, heyjackass.com, a person gets shot every 4 minutes and killed every 18 hours in the city of Chicago by gunfire. If we take a look at the city of Los Angeles, last year they had 256 homicides and they had 478 shooting victims. So look at these cities that have, and you can't even get a concealed carry license in the county or the city of Los Angeles. And of course, predominantly, these gun crimes are by gang members. This is a lot of this stuff, according to the FBI and the local law enforcement agencies, and I completely agree, are either gang-related and or drug-related.
Well, even in the city of Chicago, the homicides there by gunfire are limited to certain areas. So they really concentrate just in certain areas. And people have the impression that it's all over Chicago, and that's not the case.
No, because we go to Chicago a lot. I think if you were to take Southside Chicago out of the equation, you'd probably lose about 95% of your gun crime and your homicides.
Right. And, you know, for the eight major cities, 25% of the violent crime occurred in only 1% of the streets of that city. So
right.
they really are quite concentrated, and that 50% happened on 5% of their streets. So it's not as big of a problem as what it's made to be by the media and as widespread, but it's concentrated in certain areas. And those legislatures and those politicians in those areas happen to be Democrat. And I think that people need to be thinking about that and how they vote and what things could make a change. And the thing that is going to make a change that is so evident by this is not taking people's guns away, because that is not the problem. And in fact, these places are the most restrictive gun laws in the country, yet they have the most gun crime.
Well, there are so many levels of problems, you know, regarding how they address or fail to address or fail to understand the gun violence program or the problem. And the primary thing that they just fail to understand, and it's not because they're not told, it's because they don't believe it or they don't want to believe it, or they're too politically correct. And that is, that it's never been a gun issue, it's always been a behavior issue. So if you want to reduce homicides, if you want to reduce gun-related crime, you don't restrict the good people having guns. What you do is create enforcement programs against the people that classically exhibit the bad behavior. And when you take a look at these people, like I do, in the adjudication, the court system, and we take a look at the people who are our violent felons that shoot and kill people, these are not first-time offenders. These are people that have been that have demonstrated a history of bad behavior, a history of carrying guns illegally, of assaulting people, of robbing people, of raping people, even of murdering people. And these judges continuously release them back out into the community. These are not people that have, you know, one or two crimes under their belt. These are people that often have 10, 15, 20 or more crimes under their belt, and a number of occasions where they've been caught with a concealed weapon and during the commission of a crime. And they just turn them out in, you know, if not in a few days, in a few months, or just a couple of years, and they do nothing to mitigate the bad behavior. And of course, they're going to recidivate, right? They're going to commit these crimes again and again.
Well, and you know, I mean, having worked in an area with a high homicide rate in the past, I could tell you personally that most of the people that lived where I worked in South Central Los Angeles, most of the people were good people there. But there was a portion of the people that were committing crimes. There was a lot of drugs. There was gangs. And you're right, because what needs to happen is that the cities need to address those issues. So they need to be having harder, not softer, drug laws, harder, not softer, laws on all types of crime, but instead we're going in the reverse direction where we are allowing criminals to victimize people, and that's just exacerbating this whole problem.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned South Central, because that's Maxine Waters' district, you know, very famous Democratic leader in the Congress.
Leader, and, you say loosely.
Well, leader. But here's the interesting thing about the 2018 statistics in the city of Los Angeles. Their overall crime rate and violent crime rate went down 4%. However, in Maxine Waters' district, it went up 18%. So that is one of those areas that you're talking about where there are a tremendous amount of gangs, there's gang violence, there's a tremendous amount of narcotics trafficking. And what the heck is she doing as a so-called leader of her community to reduce the level of crime? She's out talking about impeaching Trump. She should be in her district. By the way, she doesn't even live in her own district. Okay, she lives outside of her own district. What is she doing to work with the city and the county of Los Angeles to mitigate the violent crime rate in her district?
It's what all of them are not doing, and what all of them in politics in the city of Los Angeles and the city of San Francisco in all these different areas of the entire country in these cities with high crime rates is they are going the opposite direction of, you know, handcuffing police officers from being able to make
stop
arrests,
and frisk, exactly.
Yes, from being able to know who the bad guys are, to really protect the people like they used to be able to do. And like I said, in most of these areas, the people are good people, and it's those few that are causing the issues, but now we're not allowed to take them off the streets. And if you do get them off the streets, and as you said, a judge lets them right back out to re-victimize everybody, that's where the problem is. It has nothing to do with guns. It has to do with our system of politicians that are creating laws that are, you know, just handcuffing the police and letting the bad guys back out.
Well, you know what? I want to have a cup of coffee, but I want to carry on that conversation, and I want to talk about AB 392.
This is Dr. Ron Martinelli. forensic criminologist and host of A Thread of Evidence on America Out Loud. If you'd like to find out what forensic criminologists really do in the field, and you're tired of the false narratives about law enforcement and want to unpack the cases that I've worked throughout the nation, then please pick up a copy of my new book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police, on sale right now at Amazon.com. That's The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police at Amazon.com.
Well, you know, Lynn, we were talking about crime just a second ago, and crime and policing are interwoven. The less policing you have, the more that you handcuff officers in their attempts to perform their duties and protect us, the higher the crime rate is going to be, because crime is always behavior driven. And we just talked about that with respect to gun violence. But look at what is happening nationally and, of course, to police officers and law enforcement. And California is always a leader, but a lot of times it can be a negative leader. And more often than not, California, and I know we both dump on California a lot, but it's not without good cause, has done something absolutely horrible to police officers and the law enforcement community with respect to handcuffing them in their jobs. And this is Gavin Newsom passing the legislature's bill called AB, Assembly Bill 392. They put sort of a nice, you know, phrase to the name of the bill, and it is called the California Act to Save Lives. But it doesn't save lives. It endangers lives, and especially endangers the lives of police officers.
Well, it absolutely does. And I'm just shocked that these things get through without any input by the people. They just ramrod it through, usually on a late night session, and quietly sign these things. But this is, I think, a tragedy for police officers, because they can't use deadly force without, it used to be reasonable cause, and now it's
necessary.
Necessary. Well, if you've ever been in a split second situation where you have to make a decision between your life or somebody else's, and most people have never had that opportunity, thankfully, but it happens to officers quite often, and they have to make that decision. And if they make the wrong decision, their life can be lost. And, you know, the criminals now know this, and they now know that the police are even further handcuffed. And boy, I mean, they're just going to use it against them. And I just think we're going to have tragic results here. And what's also going to happen from this, Ron, is less and less people are going to be willing to go into law enforcement. Less people are going to be willing to protect the citizens of California. And then the criminals, again, get a further leg up. This administration in California is so incredibly dangerous. And I think that the people of California need to wake up. Their governor is handsome. He looks good. He is absolutely a sheep in wolf's clothing, or a wolf in sheep's clothing, I guess is the...
You're not good with those phrases.
But he's a snake. He's dangerous. He just has taken advantage of the people of the state of California left and right, and he is not doing the will of the people.
Well, you know, the public did have access to the group of legislators that put this bill together. And as a matter of fact, it's called the Commission on Public Safety, which is, you know, just an oxymoron as far as I'm concerned. They were going to do what they were going to do. So they held, because they're required to on something as important as this, they were required to hold public meetings. And they held a couple
of public
meetings.
Nobody even knows about those meetings.
But people were following this very closely. And I, as a criminologist, and, you know, what I've done for a living in California, I'm following it intensely because of the cases that I work in California. And because one of our sons is a police officer still in California. So I'm following this thing very closely. So they did have They had survivors, surviving family members, police officers that had been killed in the line of duty. They had retired police officers, chiefs of police, deputy sheriffs, prosecutors. The California District Attorneys Association is completely completely against AB 392. They listened to all the people, and then they went ahead and they voted them right out of the ballpark, because no matter what, they were going to pass this bill. And then Governor Newsom has just recently signed it, and I agree with you 100% that this is going to cause police officers to not do their job anymore, not take the chances that they would take before in trying to protect people. And I think they're going to be leaving the state of California. Those that are young and have a good skill set and are ready to do so, they'll take those marketable skills and go to another state where they can be appreciated. But let me talk about the difference. So, wow, it has a really nice name, the California Act to Save Lives. And what could be so bad about that? Well, what is bad about it is that we already have the precedent United States Supreme Court decision, which is the federal court decision, the highest court in the land, called Graham versus Connor, 1989. And Graham versus Connor uses an objective standard, specific articulable facts and circumstances that would lead a trained officer to conclude that this is happening. Because in order to use force, especially deadly force, in the state of California, you have to have an objective standard. You can't have a subjective standard. What is that? A subjective standard is speculation. It's anybody's opinion. And when you remove reasonable force, which is the objective standard, and you replace it with necessary force, that is a huge change in the language, because we move from the objective to the subjective and speculative. So it's any person's opinion as to whether the officer should have used deadly force or not.
Then this law flies in the face of Graham versus Connor.
It does. It is in direct contradiction to the federal standard that all police officers are trained in. And as an expert, I have to analyze cases based on Graham v. Connor, and I have to give testimony based on Graham v. Connor, the objective standard. Now, here's why this is so scary for law enforcement officers. When you go from the objective, and you're protected under the federal standard, to the subjective, you are still protected in a lawsuit, in a civil lawsuit, which could be in state or federal court. You're still protected under the objective standard of Graham v. Connor. But now, and this is the key, they can prosecute you under the state law. That's the biggie.
Well,
they can
prosecute
you.
And on whose opinion?
Where they couldn't before. They can prosecute you because now you can still argue the federal standard, but they don't care because they can still prosecute you under the state standard.
Well, I want to mention this. It wasn't going to, but it is in my mind right now. You have particularly done experiments with people who have opinions about law enforcement officers, and that they shoot kind of willy-nilly at people and use it as an excuse, and that they should have known and they should have seen and they should have known this guy had a cell phone rather than a gun, and all those situations. And you have invited people to do experiments.
Very important people, by the way. People that
right,
have written
which I'm not going to say any names.
No, we won't.
But really, really interesting how that comes out, because they end up shooting the prospective suspect far more than a police officer
would. And under
would.
Circumstances when a police officer would not have shot
yes.
them, and then they didn't shoot when they really needed to shoot, and they got killed during the scenarios.
Right. So people just don't understand. They want to backseat drive this conversation without having any idea of how to drive the car. And it's really, really unfair, unless you've been in that situation where you have the chance or likelihood of being killed in a split second, and you have to make a split second decision. Do they always make the right decision? Not always, but more often than not, they do. And you have to give them some leeway in that job, or you are going to have absolute anarchy in the streets of California.
Well, and nationally, because don't forget, everybody is going to look at California and they're going to use the California template to move it to other states. You watch this happening. I guarantee you that within a year, you look at these Democratic-controlled states and you're going to find that they are going to take the language that they've used in California for AB 392, the California Act to Save Lives, and they are just going to switch the language and they're going to pass those laws, similar laws in other states. Believe me, I see it coming. And there is reasons, many reasons, for the Graham v. Connor Supreme Court decision. There's issues that you referred to in my experiments on action, reaction, perception, lag time. There is no way that a police officer who is attacked suddenly by a person can, especially one with a weapon, can adequately defend themselves when they're attacked by surprise. And wherein police officers, in the rarest of occasions, and I stress that word to you, the rarest of occasions, would act in a way that was unnecessary and excessive and shoot and kill someone. It is so rare when you take a look at, as a matter of fact, I think on a yearly basis, I think about 1,900 people in the United States are shot by police. They're not killed by police. They're shot by police. But we make tens of millions of contacts a year. Tens of millions of contacts a year. And, you know, when I wrote my Black Lives Matter book, you know, I did the statistics, and it was like 17,000th of a percent of all the times that officers use force do they ever shoot and kill someone, because only 1-2% of all the contacts that law enforcement have, all the tens of millions of contacts, ever resorts in any use of force whatsoever. Not deadly force, but any use of force. So you can see how the media and Black Lives Matters and these, you know, organizations skew the rhetoric.
Well, and it's not just them, it's the politicians also. And they're acting on a rhetoric that is not true. And this happens more and more, and they tell people that it's true. Now, when they had people standing up in front of them, begging them not to do this because of the consequences, they completely disregarded what they say.
Oh, it was like those people weren't even there.
Yes.
It was insulting. It was offensive.
And that is what Californians, you know, you want to live in this liberal state, but how's that working for you?
Well, you know, Linda, you're off to say, talk about the law of unintended consequences. This is exactly that. Why would a police officer want to stay in California under those circumstances? Certainly not a street officer. You know, if you're an administrator working in an office, you're not working the street. You're certainly not working in a high crime, you know, communities that you and I worked in. Those of us that are smart and worked in those type of environments, if you were younger, you weren't waiting for retirement and you had marketable skills, you wouldn't stay in California. Because why would you have a family, have a beautiful house, have a car, have, you know, all the toys that adults like to have, and live in a nice community, and then in a millisecond lose every bit of that? Lose your marriage, lose your family,
yes.
Lose your house, become bankrupt, and get prosecuted and stand the chance of going to prison.
And
why would you do it?
And lose it because the legislature of the state that you are working in does not have the huevos
right.
to allow police to do their job. and allow the citizens to be protected and the criminals to be the bad guys, and they have instead reversed it and made the criminals the protected ones over the people.
Right.
People in California need to wake up and vote differently. And I'm not saying because it's Republican, Democrat, liberal,
right. It's right
conservative.
And wrong.
It is right and wrong.
It's right
and it's
wrong.
About your future in the state.
This is feel-good legislation, and that's all it is. And it will have dire consequences, not only for law enforcement officers statewide, but for the very communities they serve. Because there is no way that these police officers that are working in high impact areas, where you have a lot of gang violence, you have a lot of violent crime, you have a lot of gun crime, you have high homeless populations, you just have a lot of intense violent crime. I'll tell you what, I did all of that. I did every single bit of that. And if I was a police officer today, I would think of every single way I could to leave the department and go somewhere else.
You know, what they've also done is they have further endangered the citizens of the state, because if that officer has to second guess himself before he makes a decision, and there is a person with a gun, but you're not real sure, is it a gun? Is it a cell phone? Am I going to be prosecuted? What, you know, how am I? That person has the opportunity maybe to get a shot or two off and shoot some innocent citizen. You cannot run law enforcement this way. This is a stupid way to run it, and it's dangerous.
Okay, and here's a great example. I'm glad you brought that up, because the Tamir Rice case in Cleveland a few years ago was my case, and that was the black kid with the so-called toy gun. It was an airsoft gun, but you couldn't tell the difference. I held this gun as a piece of evidence, and you couldn't tell the difference between that and a Glock. You did zero. It functioned, it weighed the same, it looked exactly the same, and the kid had removed the red tip from the gun. So when the officer, by the way, that shooting went down in a second and a half from a distance of about 8 feet. It just literally went down in a millisecond, and they tried to prosecute that officer. That's why I was involved in the case. But today in California, you would absolutely be prosecuted, because it's a subjective standard, and they use the 20/20 hindsight that you can't use in the federal standard of Graham. They'd say, well, you should have known it was a plastic gun. You should have done this. You should have done that. It wasn't necessary. Do you get where the language
yes,
comes
absolutely.
In? It wasn't necessary to shoot that kid. You should have tased him. You should have tackled him. You should have done this. You should have done that. Instead of the objective standard was, oh my God, it looked like a gun. It was reasonable for me, objectively reasonable, to believe it was a gun and to give a force warning if I had the opportunity, and I had to shoot to defend myself, because he was literally grabbing, like Tamir Rice. He was ordered not to go into his waistband. He went into his waistband. He pulled that gun out, and the officer shot him. And he only had a second and a half to do it.
Right. And now the officer is in a no-win situation, and they did this purposefully. So if he pulls that out and he gets shot, the officer is going to be prosecuted. If he pulls it out and it's a real gun and that officer hesitates, he's going to be shot. You cannot win here. And this has put our police officers, our protectors, in an impossible situation.
I feel so sad for the men and women behind the badge in California and any other state that would accept this type of assembly bill language.
Yeah.
Well, boy, Lynn, this has been a fairly heated coffee conversation this evening. are you ready to go to bed? Because this just completely pooped me out.
I think I need to read a calm book.